Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's midsummer and we're fresh from the coast. But which was it? Were we at the beach or at the seaside? Today's show is the first in a two-parter where we're pitching seaside culture against beach culture. It's bikinis versus bathers, surfers versus donkey rides, and sand and pebbles versus the end of the pier as we discuss what these two very different coastal cultures mean. Today we're focusing on the seaside, and sure, it'll sound like the tide and arcades and the sound of seagulls stealing your chips, but it'll also sound like this. The writer Travis Elbra tells us how the seaside was invented by the English and what makes it not the beach. And producer Holly goes to one of the definitive seaside destinations, Margate, on England's Kent coast, that seems to be coming back with a vengeance. Then we'll try and sum up what we've learned. That's all ahead on today's episode of Culture with Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. First of all, we welcome the writer and cultural historian Travis Elbra into the studio. Travis is the author of Wish You Were Here, about the invention of the seaside and how its fortunes have changed over the years. Now, to give you an idea of how the British view the seaside, Travis has also written books about the classic Routemaster London bus, the history and return of vinyl records, and a book about what happened when an American bought London Bridge. So might we discern that the seaside has history, culture, and deep quirkiness in almost equal measure? Here's Travis and I rolling up our trouser cuffs and gingerly dipping our toes into the water.
The seaside, in British terms, and actually even in some European and transatlantic terms, I think we, you know, the classic British thing would obviously be a pier, a promenade, amusement arcade, you know, full of those sort of electronic pickpockets of machines, you know, with
the coin dozers.
Yes, exactly.
When you can win a minion in days gone by, it would have been a fluffy teddy bear or something.
Yeah, or a toffee or something. You
know? Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But so there's a kind of almost this strange paraphernalia that surrounds the seaside. I mean, an analogy I make in the book to a certain extent is between the English pub and, say, the American bar. There's a kind of simplicity to the American bar. You know, you're there to get a drink, you sit at your stool, the bar is a plank of wood, effectively, and it's the most expedient means of getting you, drink.
Yeah.
A pub, on the whole, will be surrounded by horse brasses, all sorts of odd paraphernalia, and it's almost as if we need the sort of illusion of the sort of gin palace grandeur before we allow ourselves to unwind and have a drink. And
so there's the idea of theming things.
Yeah,
there's exactly.
There's
an idea of kind of window dressing.
Precisely, yeah. And I think the seaside does that too, in a way that we can only enter the water if we've first kind of skirted by some sort of cod Mongol architecture or you know, some other, you know, some nice bits of railings, like, you know, a flower garden, you know, something decorative to ease us into the sort of the brine.
There is a strange thing there about the high formality and the high Victorian and high Edwardianism of much of the seaside at its pomp and peak, certainly here in the UK. You have to sort of step through some ultra formality before you allow yourself to roll up your best Sunday suit trousers and dip your toes into the sea.
Exactly.
There is a strange kind of rite of passage almost.
Yeah, and some of those things that we most associate with the British seaside, fish and chips, rolling up your trousers to paddle, are kind of innovations that come from the democratisation of the coasts. Because the English seaside begins as quite an aristocratic thing, you know, these bathing resorts for health, the fact that we have the Hanoverian House, the Royal House of England at that time, and they happen to be one of the kind of sickest in Europe because they, the mad King George III and so on. So they take the waters for their health. And then when the railways arrive, that sort of democratises things. And things like paddling in the water is done largely as a means of avoiding having to pay bathing fees, which you would have to do to kind of actually swim in the water properly.
Stripped off.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So anybody would be wheeled into the beach in a bathing machine, which was like a sort of wooden hut on wheels. And those things kind of ossify and remain on the shore and become the beach huts. So there's all these kind of very complicated reasons why the paraphernalia we get at the beach, the seaside, because we're having this divide, aren't we? slippage of language there. But no, essentially, you know, the seaside, in a way, what happens is, you know, with the railways, the seaside itself becomes quasi-industrialised. A lot of the technology that comes from the creation of piers comes from railway technology, you know, the ironwork, all those railings, all this stuff. And piers themselves begin for practical means. They're initially a means with which, you know, steamboats will arrive with trippers for seafronts that don't have harbours. It's a means of that. But gradually they accrue this extra kind of paraphernalia for pleasure. There's almost a sense in a way that particularly the British seaside, that the water and, you know, maybe a bit of landscape is not really enough. You kind of need something else to sort of gee it up. And you have people like Charles Lamb, the romantic, who complains about going to the seaside and saying, you know, what on earth is all this land luggage, as he calls it, there? Why don't we just have, you know, the beach as it is? And in a sense, that's the kind of connecting point to the beach. I would say that the beach, on the whole, tends to be distinguished by good weather, for one thing, i.e. that it doesn't necessarily demand all these extra paraphernalia. It's partly about health and sport. So those elements are still there from the origins of the seaside. But it tends to be a much more kind of pared back.
The beach is a different thing. I wonder whether the seaside almost exists. The seaside exists on the beach, but it turns its back to the beach.
Yeah.
It turns its back to nature. It turns its back to athleticism. It takes its back to turns its back to swimming, even the most probably essential normal thing that you might think to do, or even sailing.
Yeah,
to be at the seaside, but to sort of deny its existence and put on a bit of an end of the pier show.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
play or ride the dodgems, or go on a carousel, or eat an ice cream. It seems like a strange thing that is always turning itself its back to nature, but couldn't really exist without it. Somehow.
Precisely, and I think that there are correlations with sport in a way that. The sands, for example. I mean, originally, the aristocratic origins of the British seaside, the aristocracy liked the idea of nice plain runs of sand because they would be riding horses on it and they'd be racing up and down. And you see the kind of diminished version.
It's like a sandy estate, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The diminished version of that in the popular seaside is the donkey rides.
Miniature railway.
Yeah, and a miniature railway. So everything kind of gets sort of weirdly reduced.
Yeah.
But then the sands, you know, in beach culture for volleyball, for example, you know, those kind of the health and fitness vein of the beach is paramount. It's a cult of sunlight. So again, it kind of emerges in that sort of interwar period to a certain extent, doesn't it? I mean, you have that idea of again turning its back on the sea is the Lido. Which are often by the seaside, but they're these separated kind of hygienic versions of the sea, aren't they? They're often very
filled with chlorine.
Exactly. So to keep all the germs away and so on. So it's like this weird reverse. The whole point about going in the sea in the first place was it was because it was salty and healthy and good for you. You're like, no, we don't want the plain old sea. That's just full of fish. We'll have some other water over here and that. And the beach. The beach sort of twists that around, doesn't it, and elevates the idea of the water and sport. I think sailing is a very important thing, and also surfing. I would say about the beach as well. That's sort of a strange offshoot of that. I always think there's that kind of, you know, the Sperry topside of shoe is, you know, the sort of epitome of beach thing, worn without socks in a kind of preppy way. You know, and the Hawaiian shorts.
We're focusing a lot of our discussion on the UK here, but there is a strange thing where places that you think might have a more vibrant, sexy beach culture, let alone a seaside one.
Yep.
This wasn't, you know, we're thinking about here about, you know, small towns in Europe that would have been fishing ports that now are beach resorts. Maybe if they're on the Atlantic, they have great waves. If they're on the Med, they just have a warmer, more azure sea.
Mm.
But no one could swim in these towns 100 years ago. No one went near the sea other than to catch fish or to sail on. It's a strange thing. The beach, both the beach and the seaside, are fairly modern inventions, aren't
Definitely,
they? I mean,
yeah.
no one would have thought of stripping off and getting a suntan 100 years ago in Brazil or in Spain or in England.
It's something like the south of France, which is effectively is a bathing resort for English expats. That's sort of how it gets going. Also, this used to happen in Britain too, which is that the aristocracy would go to the beach in the winter months, and they went there because it was warmer and there was kind of elements of the health benefits there. Similarly, kind of affluent, unwell, late sort of Victorians would go to, I mean, Cannes or whatever in the winter months as a kind of a curative thing. And it's in the 20s that the Americans, Fitzgerald and his editor, Gerald Murphy, stay on for the summer. And and that become then the sort of whole clock in a way of the seaside changes. But with those Americans hanging around in the south of France, you get the kind of cult of the suntan, and you get flat roofed houses, so you can go in nude sunbathing, nude swimming. So those elements kind of change that. But it's interesting, places like in Normandy, you know, like Deauville and Trouville-sur-Mer, yeah. Those places still have quite a lot of the classic seaside elements to them. They still have kind of promenades. But Le Havre also was a coastal resort. Ostend, similarly, Ostend was quite a nice kind of genteel place where the Middle Europeans would go for some fresh sea air. And now, in a way, has become more port-like and less seasidey, and so those are another kind of component in that mix, isn't it? I mean, in the same way that Marseille, this great hub of also modernist architecture, thanks to Corbusier, but also is this rough and ready, it's a kind of Jacques Brel place
of
kind
of that.
It would a great great vibrant place, but the sort of I always think of sort of Jacques Brel. Sort of is another one.
This is the thing, and thank you for wearing a stripy shirt.
Yes,
I was wondering about places that have succeeded in being both seaside and beach, and recently came back from Biarritz, which seems to have achieved both. So it was always it was a place of seawater cures and restoratives in the 19th century. It was a kind of royal place. Napoleon III took his Empress Eugenie there. That's what the Palais Royal Hotel it is. And at the same time, I think in the 1950s, Paul Viertel, who was an American who was Deborah Kerr's husband, came over to make a film in Biarritz and thought, wow. And he got his surfboard sent over apparently on the next plane because he didn't realise there was surf in Europe and on that part of the Atlantic coast. So that has succeeded. So since the 1950s, Biarritz has been about surfing. On the high street in Biarritz, you see sort of surfers and old ladies with small dogs. And you see promenaders and kind of beach bums. So it's quite an interesting place to get that together. That's quite rare. Maybe Cornwall.
I was about to say, actually. I mean, it's interesting that the transatlantic thing of beach culture. I mean, I sort of feel in a way, I actually argue that the classic sort of modern rockers' riots of the 1960s was essentially because British youth culture had ingested a kind of weird mixture of American rock and roll, soul music, and images of America, which were coastal America. Therefore, they were kind of the glamour of that stuff. The California, the idea that the Californian light, this stuff, kind of infects a range of European and global cultures, actually. You know, the kind of surfing thing you have, surfing in Brazil and so on. So I think that's an interesting new component. But I think you're right. I mean, Cornwall is, St. Ives, which, I remember from childhood. My grandparents lived in Cornwall in the 70s, 60s and 70s. And I remember going there as a small child in the 70s. And it's still being pretty much a kind of quaint-looking English seasidey,
More artistic aspiration than sporting aspiration.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I wonder how, Travis, this people behave. We think about beach behaviour, we kind of think it's chilled out. We kind of think it's beers, maybe it's smoking a joint on the beach, whether we're in Tarifa or whether we're in Cornwall. Yep. It has that vibe. It's something inherited from Californian beach culture, perhaps. Perhaps that is where all beach culture sort of comes from. What about the seaside? How do we behave there? How did we used to behave and do we behave in the same way, I wonder?
Historically, I mean, there was an element of it that it was always a place where you could let yourself go as long as you didn't let yourself down. So they were kind of very, very sort of...
Something we're still hoping to perfect here in the culture show.
Yeah. So I think it had a kind of a degree of license and licentiousness as well. I mean, the McGill postcards, the famous saucy postcards. So there's an element where it's a realm, Orwell's phrase, young married couples making fools of themselves on abysmal beds in kind of... it's often where, the sexuality element is quite fascinating as well. I mean, both in terms of sort of gay culture, but also in heterosexual culture. It was often where people went for their honeymoons, so it has, that sort of often the loss of virginity would occur in.
Give them an inch of woolly bathing suit, they'll take a mile, Travis.
Precisely, yeah. But often it was quite. I mean, there's a phenomenon. It's mainly a northern phenomenon of the Wakes Week. Where the factories would close down and groups of people, often from the same town, would all holiday in the same resort at the same time. And that becomes slightly self-policing in a way because, everyone is there. So all the rules in a way of your own town have just been kind of reincorporated in this coastal town. The great kind of mass observation unit in the 1930s did a couple of reports actually on coastal towns, and they found in a way they went there expecting it to be this kind of licentious wave of sex, and actually it was fairly restrained for all of those reasons. Also in those days, landladies of bed and breakfast places were fairly strict on
moral arbiters.
Exactly, so there were lots of gatekeepers about That said, you know, you still have, you know, a fair amount of sex going on in coastal places. But I think what the phenomenon in a way now, the, you know, the stag and hen party thing, it's still quite a big phenomenon within coastal places. So in a way, reenacting some of those rituals of courtship, but at a later phase, those things, you know, so people still go there to get drunk and misbehave. I think you're right about the emphasizing the idea of the vibe of the beach being more of a Californian thing. There's less intensity to it, although there may be more exercise. There's less hedonism in the kind of aggressive sense, we're going to go down, we're going to have a damn good time. That thing might be missing. But I think it's still, there's an element, I suppose, of maybe even slight superiority about it, because
about the beach.
There's
not much irony to the beach, whereas you have to inherit quite a lot to really enjoy the seaside.
To negotiate the horrors, the slips of the seaside.
And how healthy do you judge the seaside to be as an idea? And let's be international about this, because we can introduce Santa Monica Pier. And there are places all over the world that are more seaside. You know, in Soviet Russia, there were places that were more seaside than beach. It's not just end of the pier stuff in England.
I mean, Virginia Beach in the States, which I visited with my wife and her family, they live not that far from it. Mm. It's effectively like South End on steroids. You know, it's like the bigger, better, slightly cleaner, no offense to South End, version of, you know, more sleek in that very kind of efficient American way. Yeah. Version of that. So yeah, I think there are correlations of it, you know, or sort of iterations of it, kind of around the globe. Probably blessed with better weather, which sort of changes the
takes the edge off the seaside somehow.
I think the seaside does kind of need to be experienced. It is a peculiarly British creation, shall we say. Therefore, it only really makes sense in the pouring rain, the wind howling around as you're trying to eat some fish and chips with a wooden fork, you know,
being dive bombed by a seagull.
Precisely. Yeah.
That was Travis Elborough, author of Wish You Were Here, which is available for your reading pleasure, as is his latest book, A Walk in the Park, both published by Penguin. When you talk about British seaside towns, the words old and faded are often thrown around. Plenty of the places that boomed a few decades ago seem to fall into disrepair as cheap European flights were introduced and people ditched the piers and promenades for sunnier, sandier and more exotic destinations. On today's show, we're visiting Margate, a Kentish seaside town on the southeast coast with an artistic history. It was an inspiration for J.M. W. Turner and it's the birthplace of Tracy Emin. Recently, it's had a new lease of life, introduced by a creative crowd that's moved into the area. Producer Holly reports.
The journey from Margate train station to the town centre takes you on a winding road along the seafront, past 24-hour amusement arcades and fish and chip shops reminiscent of most British seaside towns. As you twist your way past slot machines and families clutching ice creams, the beach begins to unfold in front of you. And at the very end of it stands a cluster of angular roofs that resemble waves. This is the Turner Contemporary Art Gallery, and it's been the catalyst for a changing town since it opened in 2011.
The reason the gallery's there is because Turner used to come here to paint and get kind of inspired. I do think it is an inspiring place to be at the beach. So yeah, it is interesting to think back to all of those years ago. It was attracting similar adventurous people like Turner.
That's Molly Malloy, who's been a resident of Margate for a year, moving here to work at the Turner. She's part of a crowd of young people who have flocked to this seaside town in the past few years.
There's opportunity here to do things. You know, I lived in Berlin for 3.5 years and had a similar vibe that you can do things here if you want to. And I think the financial constraints of London stops a lot of entrepreneurs or creative people doing what they really want to do. Whereas here, you know, it's a lot more affordable. And there's the spaces to do things.
Claire Freeman has been here just a couple of months. She's the founder and editor of the Margate Mercury.
So the Margate Mercury is a new free quarterly magazine all about kind of modern day life and culture in Margate. So yeah, it covers the people here, kind of arts, culture, property. And I really just created it to showcase what's great about Margate and everything that's going on here.
And there's plenty to talk about here. With rising rents in London, creative communities are being pushed out of the city and are looking for the next exciting place to set up shop. I meet Molly and Claire at Resort Studios on North Down Road, a building that houses workspace for the Margate Mercury, as well as printers, jewellery makers, artists, clothes designers and plenty more besides. On nearby streets there are art galleries, shops selling locally crafted wares alongside well-stocked independent magazine racks. There's the luxury beauty brand Heckles, which uses Margate seaweed as its base and sells globally. There are busy restaurants, coffee shops, music venues and bars opening all around, most of which wouldn't look out of place on a small street in East London. I meet wallpaper designer Tracy Kendall, a born and bred Londoner who moved down to Margate a few years ago. She tells me what the attraction of the town is.
The initial thing is going to be the prices, you know, with most English seaside towns still coming out of generations of recessions. I think the prices and the sizes of property that you can buy. And I think it's that thing of suddenly we're going, my God, I can have the sea at the end of the road. And you get that, there's an instant, certainly for me personally, it's instantly calming. I walk my dog on the beach every single morning instead of being on the 250 bus from Streatham to Brixton. And you know, the comparison is, there is no comparison.
A couple of decades ago, Margate was one of those seaside towns that people might refer to as faded. It's transferred from appearing on worst place to live lists to hippest place in the UK lists. Local shopkeeper Joe Brown tells me about this change. We meet in his shop on King Street that buzzes with neon lights up for sale.
Hello, sir. May I be of any service, sir?
By the 80s, it was very much a rough and ready... Well, I say rough and ready, more of a day tripper's paradise. You know, but where one might find jelly deals, hot dogs and hamburgers, as opposed to what one will find today, which is all those things and so much more. You know, from this train station, there's something magical happens, Holly. You know, you come in from a big city like Leeds or Manchester or London, you jump off the train and you're still at 80 mile an hour and suddenly, bang, you're on the beach heading towards this interesting looking gallery to see big hitting artists. And if that's not enough, you stumble into an old town to find interesting galleries and retail operations, and it's got something hypnotic about it.
Margate has an air of optimism about it, and the reason for this is something that everyone I meet seems to come back to: opportunity. Dave McKenna is a local filmmaker who moved to the area 12 years ago. He's happy to welcome new people moving in from the city.
I think you'll see on most seaside towns, it's like that sort of creative driven culture is actually breathing new life into the seaside town and also giving it a new lease of life or something like that. It's sort of bringing out the best of what was the seaside culture, but giving people a new reason to come. And even with Dreamland, which is our Land of Dreams amusement park down there, it was relaunched last year and they've reopened again, and the local creatives that are around here have had a big part in making it a bit more successful this time. I think, yeah, the creative sector sort of and the new hipness brings out the best in the old stuff, because you've got that nice contrast. You can't actually move around the town without seeing some new bar, some new cluster of vegans playing around with an old shop, turning it into an Italian vegan extravaganza or whatever. There's lots of DFLs, as we labelled them, the Down From Londons. There is some people who are really like, oh, these Down From Londons changing our bloody town, yeah, let's just open a Wetherspoons. But I personally really, I think they've brought so much to the area and given so much opportunity, even if they are, you know, better dressed than us, have better beards, you know, embrace it. You know, they're only here for the sea, like you said, and the cheap rent.
With this hip new makeover, is Margate still a quintessentially British seaside town, though? I ask local journalist Seb Riley.
If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I'd have said yes, because the quintessential British seaside town 10 years ago was somewhere that had kind of faded and no one was going there, no one was doing these, you know, local holidays, everyone was going overseas because it was cheap to go to Europe. Now, I'd say it is, but it's what seaside towns I think are going to look like in a couple of years' time. other seaside towns are picking up the same things. I mean, you've got beach towns, places like Newquay and stuff, that are all focused on the beach and all focused on the industries, all focused on that. But then you do have seaside towns like this, and Margate's paving the way a little bit for what seaside towns are going to become. They're going to be trendy. They're going to be the centres of art.
And so do you think that seaside culture is a changing thing?
I do, yes. I mean, you look at the history of Margate, sort of 100 years ago, this was where all the city folk in Victorian times would come for their breaks. And then seaside towns changed from that to becoming, you know, sort of a fun place. And 50 years ago, there was beauty queen pageants every week here. And there was places like Lido and the Winter Gardens, which are sort of venues. And they were in full swing, and they made, everything was centered around them. And you could enter a beauty queen pageant and you could win enough money to buy a house. And that was just here, you know, being run by a local secondhand car garage or something. And then that all kind of changed, and culture changed, and civilization changes, and things move on. And seaside towns almost died. They were kind of on life support for a while throughout the 90s and the 2000s, and now all of a sudden there's this huge energy and funds being injected into here, and it means money, it means investment, it means better opportunities for the people that are here, it means more attention being paid to here, you know, all around it's a good thing. So yeah, seaside towns are changing, and what is a seaside town is changing, and I think it's moving in a very positive direction.
So can other struggling seaside towns adopt the Margate model? We'll give the final word to local Joe Brown.
Every town needs a Turner Contemporary. Maybe that's the answer for seasides that are still struggling, you know, still need investment. You know, you take Brighton, for example, it's a great seaside town. But when you walk the streets, there's art everywhere. It's great. It's all right that there's art everywhere. But in Margate, them opportunities are still to be taken, you know. And good luck to them. It's a gold rush.
While not every town in the UK will end up with a Turner, there's certainly food for thought here. If others can muster up the creative spirit of Margate, then perhaps images of faded piers and promenades have a slightly more technicolour future. After all, we do like to be beside the seaside. For Monocle in Margate, I'm Holly Fisher.
Well, we'll come to our final conclusion on next week's second half of this salty two-parter, but what can we glean so far? That when it comes to seaside versus the beach, the seaside seems to be the showy one of these two siblings separated at birth. Maybe a cheap date, but an entertaining one at least. What used to be about health and well-being became the end of the pier. The edge of the country became the destination of choice, even if its very nature was to be ignored, even if wild horses were to be replaced by donkey rides. On this show, we do like to be beside the seaside, but let's see if we like the beach that little bit more next week. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was Holly. I'm only good enough to be the chips to her Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week when we'll be tackling the beach. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.